when the shift boss hits that button, then you'd better look alive, 'cause the lumber comes a-rolling like the bees out of a hive. And you'll feel that sweat come pouring as each muscle screams with pain. And you'll wonder if it's worth it working on the long green chain.
I'm Mark Laren Young, and welcome back to the Green Chain Podcast. Last October, 2,700 people rallied at the BC Legislature to fight for BC's remaining old-growth forests and for BC forestry jobs. It was tied for the largest environmental rally in BC history. Ken Wu, the Western Canada Wilderness Committee's Victoria Campaign Director, talks about how the rally came together, what everyone's fighting for, and why it's a fight you should join.
How did you get involved with Western Canada Wilderness Committee?
It was when I was about 19 years old, and I had already been stuffing envelopes for the Wilderness Committee just for a few times, and this is in 1993, 92, around that then, and I then got a job canvassing door-to-door with them, and that kind of forced me to learn how to be more compelling and succinct and essentially, I developed a lot of my public speaking skills and public interaction skills through door-to-door canvassing with the Wilderness Committee. And through the 90s, I was primarily involved in a lot of more of the civil disobedience type grassroots groups, smaller organizations, Forest Action Network, People's Action for Threatened Habitat. And then in 1999, I was hired as the campaigner for the Victoria chapter, the campaign director.
Okay. Where did your passion come from?
I would say that I felt the early affinity when I was about literally about 3 or 4 years old to animals to begin with. And first, you know, it was things like frogs and toads in the wetlands near my house, you know, snakes in my backyard occasionally in southern Ontario. And then as I got older, you know, I read when I was like 9 years old, I discovered the nonfiction section of my public school library and just read everything I could about African savannas and lions chasing down zebras. And then I got into trees when I came out to Saskatchewan, of all places. I just remembered, you know, kind of noticing trees and thinking, those are actually pretty cool. I used to think plants were just food for animals, but they're kind of interesting in themselves. And I started getting the concept of ecosystems and wilderness from there. And from there, I just, you know, started exploring more, reading more. My dad's also an old activist from Taiwan in terms of for Taiwanese independence. And so the political aspect came naturally to me, along with my passion for nature. So I kind of gravitated towards environmental activism quite early on in my early teens.
Now, what first caught my attention about you was the story about the loggers and environmentalists sort of laying down the picket signs and the chainsaws and teaming up against the government. How did that happen?
Yeah, well, and that's kind of a funny story.
What it is and how it happened.
Yeah, well, you know what was happening is, like, I had read a lot, actually, about Judy Bari in the 1990s when we were blockading timber workers when I was with other environmental groups. I had also been following what was going on in California. And I'd spent some time in the States, in Oregon, California, and where they were actively working to make alliances with the mill workers in particular. Now, they had a lot of difficulties doing that, but they were able to make some alliances. And Judy Bari was a California activist who kind of pioneered the whole thing in the late 80s, early 90s. I had just basically followed what she was doing, but we didn't really put that into practice until the year 2000, when the Yubo sawmill on Vancouver Island near Cowichan Lake was being closed. The Timber West was looking to shut down their Yubo sawmill, and which would throw into unemployment 220 workers. And at the same time, Timber West was exporting huge amounts of raw logs that could have gone through that sawmill. So that was the time when I thought, well, it makes sense that, you know, we... shutting down that sawmill doesn't mean the company is going to cut less forest. They're going to cut down all those trees that they normally would have, but they would simply export the logs instead of creating jobs. So we could take a stance that we want to see that sawmill continue to stay open, because it's not going to affect the rate of cut if they shut down that sawmill. So I actually spoke at a public forum with Ken James, one of the Yubo sawmill workers, and myself as a Wilderness Committee, and we both stood on the same page opposing raw log exports and saying that we needed to keep that mill open. And the room full of like 60, 70 mill workers gave a huge applause when I said that we as the Wilderness Committee, support keeping that mill open. From there, we showed up at their demonstrations and protests, and then the Yuba Timberless Society leadership started showing up to speak at my rallies. And eventually, they were bringing up more in rank and file. And then from there, it led into the unions, the pulp and paper workers, the communication, energy, and paper workers, and the steel workers, working together where we agree, which is on banning log exports and ensuring sustainable logging of second growth.
Did anybody at the Wilderness Committee sort of die of shock at the proposition of, yes, I'm going to stand up and fight to keep a mill open?
Well, you know what? I think at that point, you know, people realized that it was a frivolous fight to spend your time fighting tens of thousands of workers. In fact, it's not only that, it's counterproductive. If we could create a win-win situation, which is to save the old growth, ensure sustainable logging of second growth forests, and ban raw log exports, then the workers will be happy. There's a long-term interest in maintaining a sustainable resource for forestry workers in that case. And at the same time, we could protect old-growth forests, which are incredibly scarce now in many places.
Now, you were talking about how the old forest fight seems to have moved to the island. How has that happened? Why is that?
Well, the island has always been a strong place for ancient forest campaigns, but we had to kind of build it here early on. The first rally I organized when I came to the Wilderness Committee in 1999 had 8 people, myself in a bear costume and a megaphone and 7 others. And I was talking to the megaphone thinking, should I tell them not to riot right now? But over time, it grew. So just through a constant series of slideshows and camping trips and hiking trips, we were able to pull out 100 people, 300 people, 500 people, 600 people, then 1,300 people to the last rally in March. And then just on Saturday, we had thousands of people, almost 3,000 people, which is basically matches the size of the biggest environmental rally, which was one for Clackwood in August of 1993.
Now, that blows my mind because Clackwood was everywhere and was such a huge part of people's consciousness.
Yeah.
And the idea that you scored 3,000 people last week,
yeah.
How did that happen? How did...
Yeah, you know what, there's different reasons why, but partly we've done the groundwork now. So the main thing is it just takes a hell of a lot of time to involve and educate enough people so that, because if you just call for a rally, it doesn't mean people are going to show up. You actually have to involve and educate and activate a lot of people so that you can turn out a crowd like that. And the time is coming up because there's 6 months until the BC election, and there's also a new Minister of Forest, Pat Bell, so there's expectations the government has got to do something. And all across the island, timber workers have been rallying, and so by joining forces with forestry workers, it clears a path so that we can work together. People are inspired by this sort of alliance, and we also had many First Nations speakers at this rally as well. Chief Judith Sayers of the Hoopachesset First Nations in Port Alberni, Eli Enns, who's the Tribal Park project leader for the Tlaloqueyot First Nations in Clackwood Sound. So the combination of First Nations, forestry unions, environmentalists, and seniors, kids, students, everyone under the sun out here, essentially has inspired people and has isolated the BC Liberal government and the companies, who are just about the only ones now still taking the stance that let's finish off the last of the unprotected old growth. For everyone else, we all agree that let's save the old growth, log second growth sustainably, which is 75% of the island, including 90% of the most productive growing sites, ban raw log exports, and retool sawmills for second growth. And we have a win-win situation.
Was it hard to get the loggers on board with not logging old growth?
Well, I wouldn't necessarily say that all the loggers are on board, but we work together where we agree. And most of the forestry workers at this point, certainly the mill workers, know that at this point in time, old growth is coming to an end. There's not a lot of it left. The reason the coastal forest industry is ailing is not simply because of the high Canadian dollar until recently or the collapse of the U.S. housing market, but fundamentally, its long-term decline is driven by the depletion of the resource. They've taken the biggest and best trees in the valley bottoms, the accessible areas. Now they're only left with the scraggly trees in the far west side of the island on steep slopes that are expensive to reach and yield lower returns. So they've got to shift to second growth, and it's already happening. We're just saying, let's shift to second growth, complete that transition before we run out of unprotected old growth, because it's going to happen anyways. Let's do it now rather than later when it's all gone.
Okay. What was there an event that you tied the Ancient Forest Rally to? Was there a Was there something specific, like what?
Why?
I mean, I get that 6 months of the election.
Yeah.
But what was the impulse behind having it now and bringing people out now?
Okay, the impulse now was we wanted to wait until the federal election was over.
Okay.
So when the election was over, clear a space for the public to focus provincially. And we just got a new Minister of Forests just about 2 months ago, Pat Bell. But we're not going to call a giant rally in August. No one will show up. They're all on vacation. And in September, there's election fever. So just kind of is the first opportunity we could really do it. And we don't want to call it later because in the winter months with the pouring rain, even the seasoned tree huggers, a lot of them may not show up for a rally, stand in the rain for 2 hours. So we thought it was just the best time. The earlier we get in here, the better, because it's when people, it gives a chance to keep growing the movement.
Now, who came up with this campaign?
The Ancient Forest campaign? Well,
yeah.
What happened is, when was it now? In the spring of 2006, we got a hold of satellite photo data of how much old-growth forests remain on Vancouver Island. Now, prior to that, we had primarily been campaigning valley by valley to protect, the Walbrand Valley, protect the Nimitz Valley, protect the Upper Sitka. But once we looked at the maps and we realized, and we did the statistical analysis of how much old growth remained, we realized, you know what, for the most part, Vancouver Island consists of tattered remnants, kind of like Swiss cheese, of ancient forests, interspersed or dominate in a landscape dominated by clearcuts, with the exception of Clackwood Sound, which still has large blocks left. But at this point, it doesn't make sense to fight for one tattered valley after another tattered valley. Let's get what remains of the old growth protected, because there's so little old growth left. So we made the call at that time, just about 2.5 years ago, to go for protecting the remaining old growth on the island. Now, mind you, there's some nuance to that. The mills are still geared towards old growth, so we're saying that they need to phase out old growth logging across the entire island and the lower mainland by 2015. That gives time for sawmills to retool for second growth. That way we can maintain the jobs of forestry workers. So it would be a graduated phase-out across the southern coast, so that within 6 years' time, there will be no more old-growth logging, less and less old-growth logging every year until it's done, and by then the industry will have shifted fully to second growth. But also, we do want to see an immediate ban in all flat areas, low-elevation valley bottoms, where 90% of the old-growth is gone, south of Port Alberni, where 88% of the old-growth is gone, and the eastern side of Vancouver Island, where 99% of the old growth is gone. There's got to be immediate bans there, as well as an immediate ban in all habitat needed for the survival and recovery of the spotted owl in the southwestern mainland. But other than those areas, which would be immediate bans, there would be a graduated phase out over 6 years. Kind of like, with Kyoto and with climate change, no one expects that they're going to stop using fossil fuels tomorrow. So, which is why you have emissions reductions like 20% by 2011 and, 30% 2020 and so forth until it's fully phased out after several decades and it's all renewable energy by then. Similarly, for old growth logging, no government is going to stop it all tomorrow for the simple reason there's still thousands of people and the industry is still largely tooled towards old growth. And so that's why there's a time for a rephase. Any phase out. Any government decision is going to necessarily have a timeline, and we're saying the government has to commit to that timeline because they won't even commit to that right now. They're going to have the industry transition to second growth when they're done the old growth, and we're saying let's do it sooner while we still have some standing big trees.
Is the new forest minister listening to you?
He's going to have to. For the longest time, our rallies were smaller. They were kind of out of reach, but finally we've grabbed onto their nuts and we're about to squeeze. Actually, I don't use that quote there. But they're going to have to say uncle if they're wise, because we've got the biggest active grassroots movement in the province with us now. There's no movement in the whole province can turn out more active people onto the streets and in terms of letter writing, in terms of petitions, than the movement to protect old growth forests and the ban raw log exports. And this time around, it's not just the tree huggers, but we've got communities and forestry workers with us on many of these demands.
Now, is that movement entirely based in Vancouver Island now?
No, I mean, in terms of there are ancient forest movements across the province as well, in the West Kootenays, some in the Lower Mainland. Certainly, the Sunshine Coast they're fighting over some areas there. The biggest movement right now is Vancouver Island, but I believe in the next 6 months it'll expand greatly across the province. Certainly, the southern part of the province.
Now, is that all coordinated outside of the Wilderness Committee, or is that beyond the, or is it beyond the Wilderness Committee? Like, how many organizations are? What are the different organizations that are part of this?
Yeah, I mean, there's scattered pockets of ancient forest activists everywhere. We've got a long tradition of this for the last, since the British Columbia is a great province, but since the late 70s, there's been old growth activists in the Kootenays. You know, there's out of Nelson, out of the New Denver, in the Sunshine Coast, local activists there. All over Vancouver Island, Tofino, Friends of Clackwood Sound. But I would say the Wilderness Committee is the organization that has put the most effort into organizing a massive movement. You know, our email list now hits almost 20,000 people on Vancouver Island. Our Facebook list, this last Ancient Forest Rally, we ended up inviting over 20,000 people by Facebook to the...
Well, that was interesting. One of the quotes that I read about you was how Facebook has changed environmentalism.
Yes.
Can you talk about that?
Yeah.
That's really kind of cool.
Well, basically, Facebook is kind of like email on steroids. It's a very powerful tool because people, in large part, are visual creatures. And so, and we're also social creatures. So Facebook adds in the element of photos, much more easily accessible for people to see, along with being able to send messages. And also, people being social animals and also feeling disempowered many times in these movements. Not everyone's an optimist like me or confident we're going to succeed in these campaigns. So they're less prone to support things if they feel like they're going to put in the effort and still the government's not going to listen. But when they see it snowballing in terms of first, 10 of their friends are coming, then 100 of their friends, and then like thousands of people are coming to these things, and they can watch it climb on a Facebook's events page in terms of who's said yes, they're attending these things, these events, then it's more empowering and they feel like, you know, there's a chance to actually turn things around. So, Facebook certainly has played a role in this recent upsurge as well, but it's not the only thing going on.
Okay, what are some of the other things? What are some of the other factors?
The other factors, and this is the hard thing, is the slow, difficult, painful, repeated efforts to raise environmental consciousness. So it's essentially constantly giving slideshows. I've been given slideshows probably about 4 or 5 times every month for like 10 years now about old growth forests throughout Victoria, throughout Vancouver Island, and taking people into the woods. So I've been doing hikes constantly to these different ancient forests. And just over time, people see the news articles, they come and meet us, they come out to see these old growth forests. And I believe that movements grow exponentially. For the longest time, you put in a tremendous amount of effort, and the number of people who are supporting just very slowly and incrementally inches upwards. But there's a threshold point. And I saw this happen, for example, in 1993 with Clackwood Sound. So I know it can happen here, and we've already hit that point just this last weekend, where you hit the bottom of that J curve, where it starts to go up. For the amount of effort you put in, all of a sudden you're getting a huge response from the public. And that's kind of the nature of almost every movement. They tend to grow exponentially. And we've hit that part where there's a steep climb now in response to the same amount of effort that we've always been putting in.
Do you think there's something that has activated people's consciousness?
Al Gore. So here's one thing that did happen as well, is about 2 years ago, I don't think Al Gore created this current upswing in environmental consciousness, but he certainly was one of the catalysts to trigger what was coming anyways. I have a theory that basically periods of progressive consciousness come roughly every 20 to 25 years. So if you look at the late 1960s, the late 1980s into the early 90s, when I was in high school, university, and then now in the late 2000s, early 2010 era, we've hit another peak. So movements and progressive consciousness wax and wane, and we're definitely on an upswing right now. Now, this economic recession has kind of put a damper on it temporarily, but certainly it's one of the biggest issues. Grassroots movements for climate change and environmental activism is spread all across the industrialized world. And when we're out of this recession in another year and a half, 2 years, you'll see this movement explode right to the ceiling. So revolution is just around the corner.
Well, it's interesting because, I mean, I was thinking when I was aware of what was going on in the Clapwood and concerned about that and various other forestry campaigns that I, you know, being in BC, grew up around, you always thought of saving the old growth forest as just a good thing because it was a good thing. You know, biodiversity and cute animals and pretty trees. And now people are making the connection, if you don't save the forests, we stop breathing. And that seems to be a very different, that's a very different way of looking at things. Like, now people are actually getting forests as, you know, taking as saving the atmosphere.
Yeah, there's been research to back that up as well. So, like, one of the things that you'll hear some of the dinosaurs in the logging industry say is that the best thing we can do is cut down the old growth and replant healthy, young, vibrant trees that'll save the atmosphere. And it turns out that's wrong, actually. The fact is that old-growth forests store more carbon, which is taken from the atmosphere, per hectare than any other ecosystem on the planet. And so when you convert old-growth forests to second-growth tree plantations, the ensuing tree plantations don't re-sequester the amount of carbon as the original old-growth forest, because second-growth forests only store one-half to or one-third of the amount of carbon per hectare as the original old growth. And so otherwise you've lost the original carbon as a result of the decomposition of the toilet paper going out there, you know, the pulp and paper waste, lumber products in the garbage dumps. Now there is a small amount, but it's a negligible amount ultimately stored in longer term wood products like you know, some lumber and furniture and so forth. But that's only about 8% of the carbon of the original old growth. The rest of it ends up in the atmosphere, and a smaller portion is re-sequestered by second growth. But the second growth just does not have as much carbon stored as the old growth. And that's just a simple fact.
How do you change the perception of governments, people, society, to go, you know what, that actually has more value to us as carbon storage than it does as a table? How do you help people make that shift?
Yeah, and there's a variety, and this is why we have, you know, there's different roles for people in conservation initiatives, but, you know, there's different ways to reach people. There's more, you know, the scientists play an important role by bringing forward the hard facts and the research, and at the same time, you actually have to, people need an emotional connection to these places, ultimately, too. And there's no more determined advocates for old-growth forests than those who've actually seen Carmana, you know, hike the West Coast Trail, you know, been to Cathedral Grove, Clackamas Sound.
Well, but also, I don't know how easy it is to save Cathedral Grove if it's called Timberlot 102. I don't know how easy it is to save the... I mean, I remember when the Great Bear Rainforest got named, I'm like, oh, that's genius. Because I can see it being a whole lot easier to organize to save the Great Bear Rainforest than to save that really
Central
big patch of land.
Coast timber supply area.
Yes.
Yes, and that's, you know, the governments sometimes complain about this sort of thing. But, you know, they have a fabricated name as well. A tree farm license is completely fabricated as well. For the point is, you know, names, you call things according to what how you believe it should best be depicted, but it's never the thing itself. And governments and corporations fabricate their own technical names for liquidating those ancient forests.
What can and should people do? If somebody's listening to this, what should they go out and do?
Okay, well, you know, often people say that there's no magic formula to saving the environment. You know what? There actually is a magic formula. It's a very basic one, and it's basically the maximum education and involvement of the maximum number of people. So we believe that it's an educated citizenry that exerts the ultimate lobby pressure on government. That's why we spend the majority of our time on constantly informing people, and all types of people. It can't just be your typical you know, university tree hugger. It's going to have to include people in faith groups, business owners, a wide diversity of different kinds of people from different ethnic groups, because the environmental, your classic environmental activists by themselves are just a small fraction of society, which is why, you know, conservatives who believe in conservation, business owners, folks who go to church regularly, a wider diversity of people need to be brought into the fold of conservation, because everyone ultimately, you know, has a stake in this planet. So the best thing people can do is to, first of all, get informed on the issue, especially see these areas. Secondly, tell the government what they expect. And thirdly, spread the word to others. And one way to do that is by volunteering for organizations like the Wilderness Committee.
What was the first time you saw an old growth forest?
First time, well, first in pictures. Here's a turning point in my life. When I was 10 years old, my dad bought me the Natural History of Canada series, which is like a picture book from the 1960s of different ecosystems of the country. And I saw a picture of like six couples dancing on a giant cedar stump maybe 150 years ago with a guy playing the fiddle. I'm like, that's incredible. All these people can dance on a dance floor from a giant tree stump. And at the time, I was living in Saskatchewan, and you know, I couldn't imagine a tree being that big, because in Saskatchewan, you hug a tree with your one hand. Then I, when I was 10, then I asked my parents to take me to see Old Growth Forest in British Columbia. So we actually stopped into the giant cedars trail in Mount Revelstoke National Park along the Trans-Canada Highway. And that's where I first saw the first big cedars. And then we went to Pacific Rim National Park and also Cathedral Grove. So that was when I was 10. And then I was totally a determined advocate from there.
Do you have any more big events coming up?
Yeah, so we're going to have 10 days of action for ancient forests. And that's going to be all across the province. We're planning this for 10 days in March. And at that, so we want this demonstrations all across the province in different places. In front of different MLA offices, and we want a huge mobilization to snow the government under in letters and petitions, and we want an army of thousands of people circulating the petitions and talking to people in key communities and neighborhoods across the province. So that's the biggie, and then we also have a documentary coming up, which our filmmaker Jeremy Williams is currently producing, and then we're going to be holding a series of smaller events, different demonstrations, different slideshows, different presentations between now and the provincial election in May.
When's your documentary coming out?
That documentary will probably come out in early December, I was thinking, probably about 7 weeks' time.
Okay.
Yeah.
If somebody walked over from the legislature tomorrow and said, Ken, we want to put you in charge of forest policy for BC, what would you do?
Okay, I would transform things greatly, actually. Well, the first thing I would do would be to enact concrete timelines to put an end to old-growth logging where old-growth is scarce. That's in the southern part of the province. Then I would ensure that the system of forestry for second growth is done in a more careful, sustainable way. You know, more selection logging, no logging on steep slopes, large buffer stream buffers for salmon streams, lower rate of cut. And then I would ensure that we ramp up in a big way the value-added sector side, and partly by banning raw log exports, so there's a guaranteed log supply. And at the same time, we'd have to restructure the industry so it's not based on these tenures for giant corporations, so that essentially you get more community forestry and woodlot licenses and this sort of thing. So there'd be a lot of big changes. And generally what we have to do is slow down the amount of cutting in this province, too. It's been over the top. Now, the recession has knocked down logging for a while, but it'll be back up again by the time there's a recovery. So sustainability ultimately requires we do more with less. We just can't keep taking as much as we have.
How do you feel about trees?
About trees? Well, obviously, I'm a big fan of trees. I mean, they're a spectacular creature, if you think about it. Something that can live, a living organism that can be 2,000 years old. In fact, in Norway, they found the trees there, the spruce trees up there, can be 6,000 years old. Which is insane, a 6,000-year-old living creature. It's over the top. And they're huge. I mean, it's hard to believe that a living creature, one of them, can be as big as, say, those sequoias down in California, or even their cedars over here. I just love living creatures, and I love the diversity of living creatures. I always gravitated towards animals and also monsters when I was young, because monsters are creative biodiversity. And some of these creatures are such fantastic shapes and forms. They're, they definitely get my imagination going.
Very cool. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
Thanks for checking out the Green Chain Podcast. For more on the fight to save the ancient forest, visit wcwcvictoria.org. I've got some fantastic guests lined up for 2009, and our next special guest is me. We've got a guest interviewer talking to me about The Green Chain, a movie I wrote and directed about the people behind the issues in our forests. Opening soon at a theater near you. For more on The Green Chain, visit thegreenchain.com. For the Tai'i, I'm Mark Larignan.